From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Emma Mashinini was the leader of one of South Africa's largest black trade unions. She paid for her opposition to apartheid with imprisonment and solitary confinement. On this edition of Fresh Air, Emma Mashinini talks with us about recent developments in her country. After years of acerbic lyrics, British rocker Graham Parker tells us why he's mellowed out. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Brief Lives, the new novel from Anita Bruckner. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said today that he's hoping for the start of peace talks between Israel and its Arab neighbors within 2 months. Although Shamir has not yet responded to a U.S. plan for peace talks, today's statement was his most optimistic yet. The prime minister welcomed Syria's willingness to enter peace negotiations, but he cautioned that the two sides still disagree over who should represent Palestinians at the talks. The White House said today that the situation looked promising, but that it's premature to predict how Israel will respond to the U.S. peace proposal. In South Africa, Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi's Inkatha movement has taken steps to limit the damage from disclosures that it received funding from the South African police. NPR's John Madison reports.
5 days after the press first reported that Inkatha and its trade union ally received at least $600,000 in funds from the South African police, Inkatha called a news conference to respond to the allegations. Inkatha officials said that one man had been responsible for receiving the money, Chief Buthelezi's personal assistant, M.Z. Kamalo. Officials read a statement from Kamalo, in which he said he'd taken the money knowing that the police were the source, but he concealed this fact from Buthelezi because he knew Buthelezi wouldn't approve. Kamalo apologized and resigned his position. Inkatha said it'll pay back the money that was paid to Inkatha, but it has no knowledge of the larger amount, the government funding of the union. President F.W. de Klerk told the media after a 2-day cabinet review of policy that he will not make a statement until next Tuesday. I'm John Matheson in Johannesburg.
Senators are taking up a bill that would renew most favored nation trade status for China, but they're loading it with conditions. The House recently passed a similar measure despite President Bush's threat to veto any bill that links China's trade status to reform. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The measure already demands that China stop the transfer of weapons technology to certain countries, lower its trade barriers, and make progress in the area of human rights. But today, the Senate also passed amendments that China reduce trade with Cuba and stop the practice of coerced abortions and involuntary sterility. Illinois Senator Alan Dixon rejected the argument that loading up the bill with conditions is bad trade policy.
It has been and continues to be the policy of the United States that human rights, fair trade, and one's behavior as an international citizen are legitimate considerations in our bilateral relationship.
Although the bill is expected to be vetoed by the president, supporters say it sends a signal to China that a majority in the Congress oppose its actions. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Stock prices were down sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 30 points to close at 2,983.23. Declines led advances by 2-1. This is NPR. Iraq appealed to the United Nations today to be allowed to sell its oil to buy essential food and medicines. The United Nations Sanctions Committee has denied such requests in the past, but both the United States and Britain have now said that they would be prepared to relax sanctions for humanitarian needs. The U.S. has stressed that any Iraqi transaction should be strictly monitored. A Soviet newspaper today reported a plan by President Mikhail Gorbachev to remake his Communist Party into a European-style social democratic party. Under Gorbachev's proposal, the party would abandon traditional Marxist-Leninist doctrine. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The draft party program published here today promises religious freedom, private property, and greater freedom of dissent within the Communist Party. Gorbachev himself has already pursued these policies as president of the Soviet Union. Now he's trying to get his quarrelsome Communist Party to adopt them, and in the process, to transform the party into a more tolerant and more trusted political force. But the proposal is likely to set off a stormy debate when members of the party's Central Committee meet behind closed doors on Thursday. Many conservatives on the policymaking Central Committee are already calling for Gorbachev's resignation as communist leader, and the new proposal could intensify his opposition. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The Yugoslav Federal Army said that at least two Croatian National Guardsmen were killed today in almost 6 hours of fighting between Croats and ethnic Serbs. The Croatians also fought with Federal Army units along the border between Croatia and Serbia. A peace summit held by the leaders of the Yugoslav republics collapsed yesterday when Croatia refused to demobilize its militia. Croatia has charged that Serbia is using the Federal Army in a bid to take over parts of Croatia. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the past few days, we've learned that the white South African government funded rallies by the Inkatha movement, rallies that opposed international sanctions against apartheid. Inkatha is a Zulu group that is the rival of the African National Congress. The ANC had previously accused Inkatha of being a puppet of the government. My guest Emma Mashinini is a longtime opponent of apartheid and was for years a leader in the black trade union movement. She was the first general secretary of the Commercial, Catering, and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. In 1981, she was arrested and held without trial for 6 months. The only time she was allowed out of the cell was to be interrogated. For the past 5 years, Mashinini has worked with the families of detainees and political prisoners in her role as the director of the Anglican Church's Department of Justice and Reconciliation. She works with Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Mashinini is visiting the States because her autobiography has just been published here. It's called Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. I asked her reaction to the news that the South African government had secretly funded Inkatha.
The first thing that came to me was, thank God that this has happened, because it did not come as a big surprise. We knew that there was something happening somewhere. And why it really came as a joy, it is a joy that perhaps all the violence that has been taking place in the country will now stop.
Are you hoping that there will be evidence that a lot of the black against black fighting in South Africa will have actually been organized and funded by whites?
Yes, we did think that the intervention from the white South African regime has not been valid. They have not intervened in a way to bring this violence to an end. I hope that even the Western world must begin to question itself. If the government can stop so many things, why could the South African regime not be able to stop the violence between the black on black, as it was termed? Black life has become so cheap. People have died in great numbers. So we were now concerned about, and the two parties were talking to each other, which thing did not happen in the past. People have been working around the clock to bring this violence to an end, yet someone is busy orchestrating it from behind. It does not matter which side the people are dying, it is black people who are dying, be they Inkatha or ANC.
Now that it's been revealed that the white government was funding Inkatha, what effect do you think that will have on negotiations on the end of white minority rule?
In fact, now, I really think that I wonder what is going on back at home. This comes immediately after your President Bush has announced the lifting of the sanctions. He is lifting the sanctions because they are so impressed about F.W. de Klerk and his group, and they are wonderful people. They have done so much in South Africa. I wonder what comes to the mind of President Bush himself with this revelation of what is happening in South Africa, because it is the same man, and it is going to stall. I can foresee that it is going to stall the negotiations.
Do you think that the United States prematurely lifted the sanctions against South Africa?
Oh, yes. The timing was very bad. It was really premature because we needed the sanctions now more than ever before. The reason why we needed them more than ever before is because the process of change had begun. As it has been announced in the papers, that process of change needed to be monitored and to be pressurized to be taken a little further. And the only thing which had to monitor that, it is the sanctions. Now, with the lifting of the sanctions, what other weapon do we have to monitor that the implementation of what has begun should really take place? Because we've had enough of violence. We don't want violence. We want anything that is going to take us out of this suffering with peace.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Emma Mashinini, and she's a former union activist in South Africa and now works with Desmond Tutu in the Anglican Church as the church's director of the Department of Justice and Reconciliation. And she's written a new autobiography called Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. What were the direct ways in which the sanctions affected you in day-to-day life? Were there things that you were willing to sacrifice, but that you had to sacrifice with the sanctions in effect?
I cannot point out to say these are the things that I had to sacrifice, because there isn't much which one has had long before the sanctions. Yes, there's unemployment, but I've grown up. I'm not a young person. I am 62. I've grown up to know, to find that there are people unemployed. And even during, long before the sanctions, there was job preservation. Jobs were reserved for whites, which was better jobs. Only menial jobs were there open for black people when there was no white who can do that particular menial job. Job reservation meant that they can actually even go for the retired white person to come and fill in a job. If they cannot find a retired person, they would go for retarded white people to come and do the job. Only when they do not have those people, then you had the opportunity as a black person. So that was not because of sanctions. It was partly because of apartheid itself that we did not have the job opportunities in the country, and we did not have the necessary training and qualifications because of the poor, very inferior education which exists in our country.
What were some of the most important things that you fought for in the unions that you represented?
The first thing, we were fighting for the recognition of the trade unions itself. And after that, we were very concerned, the workers were very concerned about the working conditions, the improvement on wages. And for the women, we had really achieved a great thing in 1983, that we managed to achieve the maternity right benefits for women in South Africa. Our union was a black-only union at the time, because there was a white union operating. Everything in South Africa is done according to compartments. But when we achieved these rights for women, for maternity benefits, it's not just the black woman who benefited from it. Even the white woman benefited from it.
Emma Mashinini is my guest. We'll talk about her imprisonment in South Africa after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Emma Mashinini is my guest, and she's written a new autobiography about her life as a union activist in South Africa. Now, you were arrested
and held for 6 months without trial. Can you describe what happened the day they came for you?
Oh, on the morning when they came for me, which was very early in the morning, and they came in several cars, and they were quite a number, more than 10 or so. And when they came, you know, as they would knock at the door, they knock at every window. They kick, they bang, they do everything. You open this door, they are all over. And when they got in, they just said to my family they should get out of the house. And my husband wanted to know why. And they said, you get out, I'm being detained. And they said they were detaining me under Section 22. And they started searching and ransacking the house with everybody out of the house. I state in the book that after searching, after having done everything, when they were about to take me away, and then they called my family in. Well, there was a pile of books. I do have a lot of books. And then they wanted my husband to sign for those books as things which they were taking away. And he refused and said, how can I sign for them? What if you brought them here to incriminate Emma? And it was a big issue in itself. And then they took me away to my office, to my workplace, to go and search, which was where the Council of Churches was. And many people came to give me moral support. And they took me to prison. And the first time I was imprisoned in Pretoria Central Prison and locked up with people who are on the death row.
Yeah, so you thought you would be sentenced to death,
too? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I don't know what for. Because you were just waiting. You see, they're waiting and expecting to hear from them that you will be going to court or doing anything to know why you are there. And nothing happens. And then the next thing, you are just told, pack your bags, come. And then when you go, you think you are being released, yet you are being moved from one prison to another.
When you were arrested, you were the general secretary of a trade union, the Commercial Catering and Allied Workers Union of South Africa. Did they give you any reasons for arresting you? Did you know why they had singled you out?
Never. I did not know up until the day when they left me to go home. The same way they arrested me, the same way they left me, I did not know why they arrested me and why did they release me at the same time. But it was a very horrible time just to be left alone for 6 months in solitary confinement. It was one of the horrible tortures that could happen to one.
Would you describe the cell that you were held in solitary confinement?
The first cell I was held in solitary confinement in Pretoria. I state in the book that it was so clean, small and neat because I reckon I was locked up in a section which I think was must have been reserved for whites or whatever. And the reason for that is they hide you away from even the prison warders or anybody who is working in the prison or any other person that they must never see you or see your face. I was locked up and never was to go out because the toilet and everything is there. They sealed the window and just left a very little strip for them to peep and see me from outside, and I could not see from inside, outside. I could just see the two eyes peeping at me, which was very scary. And even if they brought food, someone had to lock that. The doors were locked until someone would come and just open the door and push the food. I was moved to yet another cell, which was now very huge, big, and very dirty, with no window, windows right up there. You don't see the sun. You don't know what is happening. And it was like it was under the rail because I could hear the trains, you know, the noise of, like, the trains where I was.
Did you completely lose track of what was day and what was night and how many days had elapsed?
Well, I had, towards the end, I definitely did lose track of that. But more than losing track of the days and so forth, the most important thing that happened to me is that because you sit there, we had no books, we had nothing at the very beginning except towards the end. Was one day I sat there thinking about my family and, you know, talking to them, you know, just in my imaginations. And I saw my baby and I wanted to talk to her and call her by name. And I discovered that I could not remember my baby's name. I had forgotten my own baby's name. And this took me days to remember who her name was. This was one of the worst tortures which happened to me by me and I torturing myself to remember my own child's name.
How did it come back to you?
I think after many days of thinking of nothing and recollecting, and when the day, when it did come, I fell asleep. I slept for the day.
Oh, out of relief?
Out of relief. Out of relief of remembering my child's name.
The only time you really left her cell was to be interrogated and tortured. What kind of information did you feel they wanted from you? What kinds of questions were they asking you?
Oh, they ask you questions about my own work, about my work in the trade unions. They ask me questions about the numerous strikes which had taken place and just my operational, my day-to-day work, and ask me questions about some of the co-trade unions who I worked with. Worst of all, on the day of my being detained, I was detained with Dr. Neil Agut, who was a trade unionist himself, and he was a white medical doctor. And they kept asking me questions about him. And what angers me even today is that Neil Agut died in prison. And when I got to know, because I did not know about this, when I got to know when Neil had died, and just thought about it, that I was being tortured about Neil when they actually knew that he was already dead, but they still tortured me, asking me questions about Neil.
How were you able to not give them the information? What did you do to resist?
I had no information which I had to give. I had nothing to hide. So there was no resistance because I had nothing to tell them and I had nothing to hide. Whatever I was doing, I told them the truth. And they just thought, it is not enough. There's something more than that.
What did they do when they tortured you?
Oh, well, they would make you sit for hours or question you for almost the whole day. I never had any physical attacks or whatever, except being sworn at, being pushed around and so forth. But I was never punched or anything. But I think that psychological torture is even worse than the physical torture. That's why when I left prison, I was whisked away and had to go to Denmark to a center for tortured people just to get my health and my normality back. And I have had to be exposed to get psychotherapy for a long time to get myself back to normal health.
When you were released, before you went to Denmark, to the Center for Torture Victims, what was it like for you at home? What were some of the fears that were uncontrollable?
Oh, yes, the fears were very uncontrollable. When you had cars coming, you'd think that here they are coming back for me again. And I've had some relapses, especially when it comes to the month of November. You know, I've had memory losses. I have been seen walking in the streets, partly naked, not properly dressed, not knowing where I am going to. I've been admitted into mental hospitals, and this came about all because of the imprisonment, unnecessary, uncalled for imprisonment by the South African regime.
Now, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong here, but I have a feeling that a lot of people, when they leave the Denmark Center for torture victims, that they go back to a safer country, not to the country that they were tortured in. Whereas you went back home.
Yeah, I had to go back home. I have no other place to go back to. And besides, the struggle that one has been fighting for is the struggle for the freedom of South Africa. I am one of the lucky people to have gone to Denmark. And at the same time, if it meant me having to live outside South Africa, I had a daughter who was studying in Germany and another one over here. But this is not home for me or neither for them. And even my children, they insisted, Ma, we'd like to see you back home. To continue with the struggle, which we had begun, that we want to have our freedom. So I had to go back home. Home is home.
What was some of the most effective therapy that you had in Denmark?
Well, I had a very good woman doctor in Denmark who was... I didn't even know what it is to have psychotherapy. And it, we know little about it. Even many people at home don't know anything about it. That's why I repeat it in the book so many times that there is a thing called psychotherapy, which we have never been exposed to. She used to talk to me. She used to give me the necessary treatment. But it was not, I can say regrettably, it did not help me very much because it was almost like another isolation. I was in Denmark with a lot of people who came from Chile, from Guatemala, from so forth, those people who we could not communicate with. And I still wanted to be home because I've come out of prison. When I was in prison, I wanted to be my family. So I still really wanted to be home and to be with my family.
So you left early. You left before the treatment was officially over.
Yeah, I left before the treatment was officially over. When I left, I went and stayed for almost a month with my daughter in Germany. And we've always been in touch with my doctor, with all my doctors in Denmark. We have always been in touch, even when I'm back in South Africa. Up until now, we still are very much in touch with them.
You've never been arrested again, have you?
Oh, but I've been called in and interrogated.
Oh,
and
really?
At home, they come to my home or want me to come to the police station. If you read the book a little further, you will get to a part where you find that security say that you've been, you are a globetrotter, you've been all over the world, and you have not had a good word for South Africa, but you keep coming back to South Africa. Those are one of the interrogations which have been going on even after I've been released.
How do you deal with the interrogations now?
Oh, I think I'm much stronger now. I'm much stronger to face up with the interrogations.
How so? What do you do that's different
you
from...
You are able to react strongly and you just don't give in easily to people pushing you around. And too many people have been detained. People have suffered much more than myself. And we just thought that we cannot give in so easily to these people who are oppressing us.
You're working with families of people who are imprisoned and detained. How now is the kind of people being imprisoned changing or the things that they're being imprisoned for now that the emergency laws aren't in effect?
Well, I think that the numbers are really coming down. The numbers of detainees have dwindled, but not all political people, prisoners, are out of prison. But most of the people who are being detained have been released. We still have some who the human rights lawyers are still talking about, and even those people who are on the death row for political reasons who have not as yet been released, we are concerned about them, and we are still working around that issue of capital punishment.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry. It was good talking to you.
And my guest has been Emma Mashanini, and she's written an autobiography called Strikes Have Followed Me All My Life. She's a union activist and human rights activist in South Africa. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For 15 years, British rocker Graham Parker has been singing and writing songs known for their biting lyrics and angry tone. But now he's also singing about kids, dogs, and butterflies. Coming up, Parker tells us he settled down, but there's still plenty to be angry about. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel from Anita Bruckner. Bruckner keeps busy. She's a novelist, art professor, and editor of a recent collection of Edith Wharton stories. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker says that Israel should stop waiting for clarification on the Palestinian question and simply decide whether or not to take part in a Middle Eastern peace conference. Baker is now in Malaysia, where he attended a conference today of Southeastern Asian foreign ministers. Mary Kay Magstead has more.
Baker said if the Israeli government would just agree to participate in a peace conference, as other governments have already done, details could be ironed out. This could include the issue of Palestinian representation. He said President George Bush had hoped Israel could come up with an answer before the Moscow summit, but that was a wish, not an order.
We are not setting any deadlines, as I said in Israel. There are no deadlines. I think what the president indicated was that it would be, that he, I think he said he would like, if possible, to receive an answer by that time.
For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Israeli Prime Minister Shamir says that he hopes that Middle Eastern peace talks can get underway in 2 months' time. The Prime Minister, who has not responded to a U.S. plan for a peace conference, compared a change in Syria's willingness to talk to Israel to Egyptian President Sadat's visit to Israel back in 1977. The U.S. plan calls for a peace conference that would lead to direct talks between Israel and its Arab neighbors, and it calls for peace talks to be co-sponsored by the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The government of Turkey has released conditions under which it's allowing a multinational rapid reaction force to be deployed near its border with Iraq. The force is intended to protect Iraqi Kurds against any possible attacks by the Iraqi army. Jonathan Rugman reports for the BBC from Ankara.
The Turkish government insists in its conditions that the force is a temporary one. The Turkish contribution of some 900 men to the eight-country coalition will be under the control of a Turkish commander, equal in rank to the commander of the entire task force. The two commanders are to share all information, and no cross-border action will be possible without Turkish government permission. In a statement, the Turkish government says that none of these conditions will be interpreted as a sacrifice of sovereignty rights. It's probably this issue of sovereignty which has caused delay in the planning of the Rapid Reaction Force. The Turkish government is under pressure from public opinion and opposition politicians to justify the use of Turkey as a base for further Allied intervention in Iraq.
Jonathan Rugman reporting for the BBC from Ankara. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 30 points to close at 2,983.23 on volume of some 162 million shares. Trading was active. This is NPR News. According to a new government study, the after-tax income of the richest 1% of Americans more than doubled over the last 10 years. At the same time, a study by the Congressional Budget Office found middle-class households gained very little, and low-income people became poorer. The richest 1% was considered to be households with incomes of $253,000 or more for a family of three. The middle-income households earned from $27,000 to $41,000 a year. The study found that high-income people are earning more, due in part to large increases in capital gains, while federal tax policy is also adding to the differences in income. A society of pediatricians has called for a ban on food advertising targeted at children, saying the ads promote unhealthy eating habits. NPR's Cheryl Duvall has more on the story.
The American Academy of Pediatrics charges food manufacturers with being more interested in profit than nutrition in a report issued today in Chicago. The Academy says that roughly half of all television food ads are aimed at children, who in turn pressure their parents into buying foods that are high in fat, sugar, and cholesterol. Authors of the study say that one in every five children in the United States is overweight, and that about a third have high cholesterol. Makers of sugared breakfast cereals and snacks were quick to criticize the report. They say that their products are nutritious and that they are within their right to advertise on TV. The Federal Trade Commission has rejected previous appeals to ban such advertising from the airwaves. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
The Pentagon says that the U.S. plans to sell 8 F-16 fighters to Turkey for close to $3 billion. Unless Congress turns down the plan, it becomes law in 30 days. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. British rocker Graham Parker may be best known for his bitter relations with his record companies. He's been on five different labels during his career, and some of them inspired biting songs, such as Mercury Poisoning, his parting shot to his first label, Mercury Records. Graham Parker came on the British music scene in the mid-70s. Rock critic Robert Christgau wrote of the songs on Parker's first album, Howling Wind, "Their fury is unmistakable. In the time-honored English manner, bass and drums play the house-rocking rhythms of Chicago and Detroit for righteous anger rather than good-time escape." Parker's reputation as one of Britain's angry young men has been tempered in recent years. On his new album, Struck by Lightning, he sings about settling down into family life. This is his song, Brand New Book.
Somebody's life, I had a few moments to spare. He was a good man who lived with his wife, with the usual kids in his hair. There was happiness, a lot of weirdness, and a sprinkle of tragedy. I pulled it by chance from a secondhand bin, but it could have been written just for me.
Graham Parker, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hello, thanks for having me.
I want to quote part of the lyric from the song we've just been listening to, and I think everybody who hears the album notices this line, because the words came out, not twist and shout, because that's not what a grown man writes about. I'm wondering when you started feeling that your songs had to change to reflect how your life had changed?
Well, I think the idea behind that first off was kind of sort of anti-MTV bands, really, who all seem to be sort of, you know, singing about youth things, and some of these people aren't quite so youthful, you know. So it was kind of about that, really. That was the idea of the line, but I guess then it sort of took on a different meaning, really, relating to me. Because, you know, you go through this period when you're, after like two or three LPs, I went through a period of thinking, you know, what do you write about now? I mean, what is it all about? I'm 28 or whatever, and you can't keep writing about the stuff that burned you up in the first place, you know? Luckily, I've just been able to formulate what's going on, what I see and what I feel, into different kind of songs, like you see on the new record on Struck by Lightning. Get songs like The Kid with the Butterfly Net and Strong Winds and
Children and Dogs,
yeah, things that could not have been 5 years ago. And I feel kind of lucky that those ideas have come to me and I've been able to put them into songs and not gone strayed from my original, hopefully, integrity, you know.
Is it hard to write about children and dogs and subjects like, you know, being a father?
Yeah, it is with any kind of credibility. Yes, it is, to make it interesting. But it's all hard. You know, this whole thing is just work. That's basically what it is.
But what's particularly hard about writing, for instance, about being a father?
Well, you can't be mushy about it or sentimental. You just have to... I just try to find the humour in it. I mean, people often think my songs are so deadly serious, and there is some serious stuff in there, but I find it funny, most of it, you know.
I want to point out that it would be a cliché and incorrect for our listeners to assume that because you're writing songs about children and dogs that it means you've lost your anger. Because you haven't. I mean, and there's still angry songs on the new record.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, she wants so many things.
Exactly.
It's fairly vehement, you know. Yeah, you can write. I can write angry songs in my sleep. Really, it's easier to write those kind of songs than anything else. But you just have to put it into some kind of format where you're cutting sort of below the flesh a little bit with it. So it really is spiky, you know. But it's hard to write love songs that are good, that don't just have Moon in June things, I think.
Your album came to us with a press release written by you, I think, that kind of details everything that went wrong with previous records and previous performance tours. Yeah. It seemed like a strange kind of press. You know, press releases usually are in praise of everything.
Mm, yeah. I hate those things, you know. It's... Graham Parker started he was born at an early age, you know, became slightly taller than he was, you know, and played in the great pub rock, you know, all that junk, which I really quite dislike. It's all very simplistic. I thought it was better to be a bit cutting about it and have a little dig at the producers and you know, generally make it fun than being too sort of serious, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Graham Parker, and he's got a new album out, which is called Struck by Lightning. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Singer-guitarist and songwriter Graham Parker is my guest. Let's talk about how you got started in music. Where did you grow up, first of all?
I was born in London. I grew up in a place called Deep Cut, Camberley, Surrey, which is suburban country area, about 35 miles out of London, very near a town called Aldershot, which is known as the home of the British Army. And very near where I grew up, there were barracks where soldiers would be, and also some quite nice countryside, but you know, suburbia as well, a mix of places really.
So, did you go to a school with a lot of kids whose parents were in the army?
Yeah, exactly. Quite a lot of them were. They were always getting their boxes in from Malta or Cyprus or something. The boxes are coming. My guitar's in there, you know. And it's 6 months later, the boxes arrive. You know, they'd settle into their new home, and then they'd be posted to, you know, Saudi Arabia or something. So, I met a lot of interesting kids who were kind of rootless, really.
Did you relate to them, or did you feel different from them?
I felt different from everybody all the time. I felt totally different, you know.
What was it about yourself that made you feel so different?
I don't know. It's hard to pin down, really. It's just that feeling that you've got something, you know, that you want to relate somehow. God, I can't really remember. I just know I felt a bit unusual. I think being slightly smaller than everyone helps a bit. You know, most kids who are smaller. Now I'm sort of grown up, I look around, there are lots of people shorter than me, but at the time it seemed like I was the shortest person in the world, you know. And you just wish you were like everybody else, but you know you're a bit different. Also, I felt as though somehow I'd missed a year at school, and I didn't know where the year went. Everybody seemed to know these basic things that I had no idea about.
What kinds of things?
I don't know, just like adding up and subtracting and things and, you know, basic sort of history things. I just didn't understand why other people knew these things and I didn't. So I imagined for a long time that I'd lost a year somewhere. Maybe I was abducted or something by aliens or something like that.
That must be it.
But, it, you know, I think this is, kind of thing that sort of gives you the conviction to do things alone, and that's what I did. I learned to write, play and write songs alone, you know. You know, that's given me a good background to keep on doing it, I think.
Did you play in bands when you were young, or did you mostly play in your room?
I had bands. I had a band when I was 13. We were called the Deep Cut Three, and then we became the Black Rockers. And then when I was 15, various bands. I think The Way Out was one of them, sort of a R&B kind of band, you know. But we couldn't play well at all. I was a very slow learner because I do everything my own way. And I really started learning guitar when I was about 21, when there was a kind of big singer-songwriter thing going on, the James Taylors and all that kind of stuff. So then I got a bit more serious about acoustic guitar and learning to play. But, you know, I didn't... it took me a long time, and I'm still learning now. I'm still becoming a musician as I go along.
You had said before that you really hate the kind of press release that says Graham Parker, blah, 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 started the pub rock scene, blah, 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 because that was really simplistic. But, I mean, it is true you were a really important part of what's, you know, become known as pub rock. And, you know, you got started playing at the Hope and Anchor, which was one of the big...
Yeah, well, people say that. I mean, I was a guy from the suburbs who wasn't playing regularly in bands or anything, and I met these musicians who were known as pub rock people, the Brinsley Schwartz and Martin Belmont, and we played about 11 gigs in pubs, but, you know, everyone plays it. The Police were playing in pubs, you see, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody says great pub rock band The Police, you know. I don't really get it, you know, it's not my scene. You just start off playing in pubs because there's nowhere else to play. I mean, where else is there? It's like playing in bars. You don't call Huey Lewis a great bar player, you know? He's a pop star, you know what I mean? And he played in bars all around San Francisco. So, you know, I find that a very limiting idea, personally. A few months we were playing concert halls and stuff, you know. So it's the association with those musicians that got me into that sort of categorization, I suppose.
Was it at all helpful to you when you started, you know, recording in the latter part of the mid-70s to note that there was a, you know, something that was considered a movement, new wave or pub rock or whatever, but there was a category of people who were new, who were doing something different, in part by returning to the roots, but there was a place that you could be different yet fit into. I'm wondering if that felt useful.
Well, I felt that I was really the only one who had any idea when I emerged with the Rumor and made my first record and started playing around. I was the only one who really had any idea. I was acting like I was grabbing the world by the throat, and I was very aggressive, and I was saying, this is it, man, this is what's going to happen, this is what's happening now. And I saw other people, like Elvis Costello with his band Flip City, with about six people playing in the Hope and Anchor. Six people came to see it, I think, and he was the same. There was no aggression, no attack, no look at me, I am serious, man, you know. And I was totally different from that. So I emerged and got successful quicker than these people, and then they would come to see me and see what was going on, and I think that they picked up stuff from me. And then, of course, the Sex Pistols came along, who took it to a whole different level altogether, where they actually, Johnny Rotten said to the audience, I bet you don't hate us as much as we hate you, which I wish I'd said, you know. I really do.
Why do you wish you'd said that?
Well, that's better than, you know, making five LPs the hard way. Just coming up with a phrase like that is going to catapult you into stardom, you know. That was a great thing to say, and very true as well, because all these people are sitting there, you know, and this scruffy bunch are playing hideously and was like playing hard, fast, 3-minute songs, you know, and not sort of drinking beer and, you know, looking like I was enjoying myself, you know. So anyway, then that new wave thing happened and made it possible for people to be serious about it again, you know.
Let me play something from one of your records with The Rumor. And this is a track from your album Squeezing Out Sparks. And this is the song Nobody Hurts You. Do you want to say anything about this song?
This whole album had a very sort of almost conceptual thing about the suburbs of England, I think. It was me, after going away and touring and doing what I was doing and becoming, you know, a musician and a person with a record deal and making records, me coming back and looking at the suburbs of England a bit. And Nobody Hurts You has some references to that, and Local Girls does as well.
Okay, here we go. This is Graham Parker. Graham Parker from his album Squeezing Out Sparks. And I should mention, Graham Parker has a new album. It's called Struck by Lightning. Well, you're living in the States now.
Most of the time, yeah. Upstate New York, I spend most of my time there.
Is that because you're married? Did you marry an American?
Yeah, that's right. But I spent a lot of time looking around there, and I love the country and the mountains and the wildlife and stuff. I'm a bit of a country person at heart, really. And I've lived in Manhattan, spent a lot of time in Manhattan, which is great fun, but I've got a kid and didn't really want to you know, be one of these girls who work in Balducci's and don't say please and thank you, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's nice to be in the country.
Graham Parker, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Graham Parker from his latest album, Struck by Lightning. This is She Wants So Many Things.
She wants so many things you can give to her. She wants so many things you don't have much. She wants so many things you can deliver to her. She wants so many things all at once, like a brick wall that'll keep her from crumbling, and a camouflage jacket to hide from herself in, and a system of worship like a powerful magnet that'll jar in the heathens, pick them up in a dragnet and pull them underwater till they all go stagnant. And she wants so many things beamed in on a satellite, served up on a silver tray, a wasp and a parasite. She wants so many things, where you gonna find them all? She wants so many things, get up and run.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we'll have a report from the Soviet Union. President Mikhail Gorbachev has apparently drafted a new party platform for the Communist Party, which downplays the debt to Karl Marx and, for the first time, does not concentrate on the class struggle. We'll have reports on the increasing violence in Croatia. Susan Stamberg has a feature on writer Andrei Debuse. We'll have reports from Israel on the coming peace conference, and big news in the United States, breaking news, cold air from Canada. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Summer entertainment isn't just action movies and trash novels. If you're looking for something with a subtler punch, Maureen Corrigan has some recommendations. Anita Bruckner's new novel, Brief Lives, and a two-volume collection of Edith Wharton's short stories, most of which haven't been in print since the 1930s. The collection was edited by Anita Bruckner. Obviously, Bruckner's been keeping busy.
Anita Bruckner is one of those irritating people who never wastes time. During the school term, she lectures on art history at Cambridge and other prestigious institutions. Then, on her summer vacations, she cranks out critically acclaimed novels like Hotel du Lac and Lewis Percy. Bruckner's novels are remarkable for their stunning psychological insights, but they're also claustrophobic. The typical Bruckner plot revolves around one character whose life is dwindling to point zero. Think of what Jane Eyre's middle age would have been like if she hadn't met Mr. Rochester. That's Bruckner's kind of story. Brief Lives is another stifling masterpiece, but I don't recall Bruckner's other books being quite so funny. Critics have always compared her to Jane Austen and Barbara Pym because of the slim scope of her novels. Now Bruckner shares more of their humor, too. Brief Lives tells the story of an uneasy friendship between two women who are thrown together because their husbands are business associates. Faye is the polite narrator. She consciously plays second fiddle to Julia, a glamorous ex-cabaret star who still needs an adoring audience. For over 30 years, Faye and Julia share superficial conversations and a simmering dislike of one another. But the world of Bruckner's novels doesn't offer infinite possibilities, so Faye and Julia stick together out of habit. Bruckner's appeal lies in her ability to chronicle the neurotic and lazy patterns of people's lives that aren't usually the stuff of fiction. She never makes Faye and Julia's friendship more significant than it really is. Instead, it's fascinating and familiar because it's so lukewarm. Bruckner's tight-fitting truths make me squirm, but in Brief Lives, she's eased the way with some gallows humor. Apparently, Bruckner has also been busy in her spare time rummaging through Edith Wharton's library. Wharton is one of Bruckner's mentors in the art of saying disturbing things in a well-bred voice. This collection testifies to her gimlet eye and her dowager's impatience for pretension. The 28 stories deal with divorce, greed, ghosts, and the legacy of the Civil War. I imagine Wharton spent a lot of evenings gossiping with her pal, Henry James, about the sort of social climber she ridicules in her story, The Pelican. It's about a woman who makes her living swallowing up stray bits of arcane information. Then she regurgitates them in genteel lectures at ladies' luncheons. Two other stories, The Reckoning and Her Son, are almost as devastating as Wharton's masterpiece, Ethan Frome. When you read Wharton and Bruckner side by side, it sometimes feels like you're reading the late Victorian and the modernist versions of the same stories. Wharton, like Bruckner, writes about the inner struggles of a single character. But in Wharton's fiction, you sense a rigid society in the background, manipulating the character's actions. In Bruckner's isolated, contemporary universe, the characters only have themselves to blame.
Maureen Carrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Brief Lives by Anita Bruckner and the stories of Edith Wharton. We'd like to hear your comments about Fresh Air. Give us a call on our toll-free line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn about the long, covert relationship between the Pentagon and Israeli intelligence, a relationship that the Coburns say has influenced everything from the Gulf War to the war on drugs and perhaps the October surprise. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.